Not long ago, the PGA Tour was at a tournament known as the RBC Heritage. A young man by the name of Morgan Hoffman dominated the early headlines, not because of his stellar play, but rather simply because he was playing. It was the first time that Hoffman had played in a tour event in about 2.5 years. He did play well, but the fact that he was in the field is really what was noteworthy. You see, 5 years ago, Morgan Hoffman was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy. He was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy, and he's playing golf professionally. I personally think that's kind of the makings of a Cinderella story, don't you? But of course, not everyone would agree. Morgan Hoffman's playing partner was a young man by the name of Harold Varner III. Varner was asked if he noticed any changes in Morgan Hoffman's golf swing since he had played golf with him last. I think, just for what it's worth, this would have been a good time to sort of gush about the fact that a young man in the process of overcoming insurmountable obstacles to live out his dream of playing professional golf. That's what I would think would be good. Anyway, Varner said the following in answer to the question. He said, "I did not, but I'm not a very aware person, never have been. I'm out there to beat Morgan. I don't really care. I get that he's been through a lot, but everyone on the planet's going through something, and that's his battle. My battle may come down the road later. That's kind of messed up, but it is what it is." I'm tempted to say, accepting the humanitarian award for Harold Varner. Now, I agree with one thing that Harold Varner said. His view is messed up. I'm just going to say, I think it's totally messed up. I get the idea, after all, that men are competing against each other on the PGA Tour, but it's a game, right? Couldn't there be a moment of an attaboy or something for this young man who is working so hard to overcome his challenges? Varner's response demonstrates the state of our world. It further demonstrates the reality that that's been the state of our world for a long, long time. Now, not to ruin your Sunday, but the world is filled with sinful, self-absorbed, narcissistic people who at times are so involved taking selfies, they don't even realize there's a world around them. The Apostle Paul is concerned about the sinfulness of the Corinthian people, and he's going to tie some of his concerns to some warnings from Israel's history. You see, the current culture isn't the first group to be sinful and narcissistic. Neither were the Corinthians the first group to fit into that category. And Paul is going to spend his time connecting the dots. So let's join him. We continue our series through the book of 1 Corinthians, called to be saints together. We find ourselves this morning in the 10th chapter, beginning with the first verse. And if you're able, I will invite you to stand, please, for the reading of God's word. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 1. "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, 'The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play.' We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it." Thank you so much. You may be seated. Now, remember what Paul had been talking about in the previous chapter. I know that a lot has happened in your life and in the world But think back to what we dealt with just a couple of weeks ago when we studied chapter 9 together. Paul had been dealing with the idea of giving up one's personal rights for the sake of the gospel of Jesus. That's a big theme, in fact, throughout an awful lot of the Apostle Paul's writing. Let me also mention that the last verses of chapter 9 simply remind us, that these have oftentimes been misunderstood. We talked about it somewhat a couple of weeks ago, but I want to make a connection here this morning. Paul is talking in chapter 9 about disciplining his body. Some have seen that to mean punishing one's body as a form of spiritual discipline. That's not what Paul means. He's not about punishing his body. We noted last time that Paul recognized the importance of disciplining his body, and certainly that was for the purpose of spiritual growth, assuring that he would stay in his calling to share the gospel of Jesus, lest he miss out on receiving rewards from the hand of God. Chapter 9 is most certainly tied to chapter 10, and we'll see that momentarily. So a detour and then four main thoughts to highlight this morning. The detour is simply this as we begin. There is a connection between the people of God under the old and new covenants. There is a connection between the people of God under the old and new covenants. Verse 1 of chapter 10, Paul says, "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea." Paul begins this 10th chapter with the word "for." The reason that's important is that we need to see how he is, in fact, tying that older section to the newer section. Paul has been talking about being disqualified. The danger of being disqualified is real, and Paul will demonstrate that fact by alluding to the Israelites in the wilderness. And he utilizes this formula often when he writes, "For I do not want you to be unaware," or "I do not want you to be ignorant, brothers." And then he goes on to mention what he calls our fathers. Now, I know at this point you're likely saying to yourself, "Oh my word, this preacher is stopping at every word. We are never going to get out of here today." You will, I promise. I didn't hold the other two services captive, and I promise I'll let you go too, because I enjoy lunch more than most of you. But this is noteworthy. Please notice, if you will, what Paul has done. He is talking to the believers at Corinth, and he's saying he doesn't want them to be unaware or ignorant about what had happened to the Israelites, and he refers to the Israelites, are you ready, as our fathers, or some translations may say our forefathers. The problem is, if you and I don't stop and smell the roses here, you might miss something that's really big. Mainly, Paul is writing to a Gentile church and mentions the Israelites as our fathers. Clearly, Paul is making the connection between the people of God under the old covenant, that is Jews, and the people of God under the new covenant, Jews and Gentiles who believe. Now, I don't want to camp here too long because I know some of you would want to get home to watch Joel Osteen. But this is a big deal. The Israelites are the chosen people of God. We read all about that all throughout the Old Covenant. And now the church, Jews and Gentiles, are chosen by God under this new covenant. If you belong to Jesus, you were chosen by God. Isn't that beautiful? If you belong to Jesus, you were, in fact, chosen by God. That's no cause for pride, because you didn't do anything to earn it, but it is most certainly a cause for celebration, because you are known, you are loved, you are forgiven, you are chosen by the very God of the universe. And that ought to make a Baptist dance. Don't do it, because I've seen some of you guys do that. So Paul is simply transitioning to talking about disqualification due to the lack of self-discipline, which led to sin, to illustrating the problem of disobedience among the people of Israel. Now, I recognize that the Jewish people are special to God. I do not wish to downplay that at any level. But I also recognize that from the time of Christ's coming, Jesus said he is the only way to be made right with God. And he didn't seek to split theological hairs at that point and say, unless, of course, you're Jewish. So, Jews and Gentiles alike must now come to God through faith in Jesus. So there's a connection between the people of God under the Old and New Covenants. Now let's get to the main stuff. First of all, God's people are provided for by God in His time. God's people are provided for by God in His time. Verse 1. For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Now, let me pause there and mention, I know you probably have forgotten what we talked about a couple of weeks, or talked about last week, in fact, about how Jesus had always existed. There's never been a time Jesus was not. In fact, Paul will back that up with what he's saying here because he's talking about the children of Israel and he's tying Christ to them all those many years ago. Now, verse 5, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. God's people are provided for by God in His time. Paul is going to now take a playbook from God's dealings with His chosen people under the Old Covenant. He's going to remind them at some level of what God's people had. So let's pause and think for just a few moments about what the Jewish people actually had. With what things were they actually blessed? They experienced protection. They experienced guidance. They experienced forgiveness. Think about it as you've gone back and I know read the Old Testament. How many times did they mess up and God gave them another opportunity to straighten up and fly right, as they say? God provided for His people in countless ways. The Bible records, for example, in Exodus 13, how God's presence led them as a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. As you'll recall, they even had to cross the Red Sea at one point, and God provided then as well. The sea opened up. Remember the story? The sea opened up, and the Israelites were allowed to cross over, and then the sea closed up and drowned the Egyptian army that were in hot pursuit of them. Now, the problem for many of us is this. We learned that story as children, so we've been familiar with that for a long, long time. Things like that have a tendency to sort of lose their luster, or the punch they pack goes away. But here's what's so amazing about that. It really happened. It really happened. And it really happened that way. Can you imagine having been there that day? Being a part of that? And then just think about the stories that you could share with your children and grandchildren. You'd probably call them to your side and say, now listen, I know that your granddad talked about walking to school uphill in the snow both ways, but let me tell you what happened to me. And it really happened. They were baptized into Moses and in the cloud and in the sea. Israel was immersed, if you will, into Moses. This is a demonstration of their following him, their togetherness with Moses as their leader. They placed themselves under his leadership. Now, we know that they didn't always follow without some murmuring. We know that. But think about what God had provided for them. And yet, even with all they had, God was not pleased with them. And that was apparent by what the Apostle Paul writes in verse 5. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness, or as some translations render it, they were laid low, or they were struck down. So God's people are provided for by God in His time. They disobeyed God, and you know the story. They ended up wandering in the wilderness. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink. Some would argue that spiritual in describing the food and drink really isn't the best translation of the Greek text. Obviously, Paul recognizes that manna and water were, in fact, physical, but it might be better to translate the word as supernatural, meaning the provision, while physical, was provided via supernatural means. They were provided by God. The manna and water were certainly necessary for their nourishment physically, but they were also of spiritual value. They nourished their relationship with God. This is evident by the way Paul equates the rock, which provided the water, with Jesus Himself in verse 5. So God provided for his people at the right time, in his time. How many of us could raise our hand or stand up and say, God has done the same for us. God has always come through. God has, in fact, provided for us. We didn't know how things were going to turn out, but they turned out. We had no idea how we were going to get through what we needed to get through. We didn't know how we were going to end up with what we needed. And yet, here we are. Why? Because God provided for his people. God provided, in fact, for his people in the Old Testament era. God provided for his people as recorded in the New Testament. And listen carefully, God still provides for his people today. Hold that thought. I had a great life growing up. I wouldn't trade any of that for anything, but we didn't have a lot of money. And looking back, in fact, I'll tell you, I'm glad that was the case for a lot of different reasons. I wouldn't change any of it. When I was a college student attending Missouri Baptist College, now Missouri Baptist University in St. Louis, I paid a certain amount of money each month for tuition, and I also utilized student loans. I worked part-time at a church, and I worked part-time at McDonald's. I didn't have to walk to school in the snow, uphill, and so forth, but I did end up having to work about 35 hours a week while going to school full-time. One year, as the semester was winding down, I had been invited to lead worship for a revival week at Westview Baptist Church in Belleville, Illinois. It was pretty close to my hometown. Jim Robinson was their worship minister at the time, and the truth, Jim's still there. Jim's been there for a long, long time. And Jim was literally the stuff of legend. He was so well respected and so loved, and he was so kind and gracious and took an interest in me. And he invited me as a college kid to lead worship in their church for this week of revival meetings. I really can't explain to you what a big deal that was to me. I was serving a church of about 80 people or so, maybe 100 people, and I walked into this big, beautiful, gorgeous sanctuary with an organ that would raise the dead. And man, when I walked out on that platform, I'm just telling you, I was so thrilled. And they had great musicians and a big choir, and I got to lead them. The semester was winding down, and I owed about $850 to clear my debt to the college for that term. And I was worried about it. I'd put back what I could, a little bit of money, but I was running out of time. And I'll never forget going to the mailbox that next week after that revival and opening an envelope with a check from Westview Baptist Church. This was the spring of 1985. And I opened the envelope, and the check was for $840 and some change. And I walked back into our little house, and I sat down at the kitchen table, and I put my head down, and I wept with gratitude. I will forever be indebted to Jim Robinson and the people at Westview Baptist Church. God provided my needs through them. So God's people are provided for by God in his time. Secondly, not only God's people are provided for by God in his time, but God's people respond with presumption at times. God's people respond with presumption at times. Verse 6 and following. Now these things took place as examples for us that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. God's people respond with presumption at times. Now, I really hate to have to make that point this morning. I don't want to be negative. I don't want to make people feel guilty. But the fact of the matter is, it's true. Even the people of God at times respond with presumption. It was true of Old Testament people. It was true of the early church. And guess what? It is true sometimes of the people of God, even to this very day. Now, I'm not sure, I don't know exactly, But I think it's because sometimes we forget from where we have come. Paul has been comparing the attitude of God's people under Moses to the arrogance of some of the Corinthian Christians. The Corinthians, too, had been through the waters of baptism. They were involved in common meals. They were physically and spiritually nourished. Just like the people of God under Moses, these Corinthian believers were on the receiving end of so much blessing from God. The problem was they had become so obsessed with their rites, they became presumptuous in their walk with God. Now, we know from verse 5 that we read just a moment ago that God was not pleased with most of them. In fact, the generation that left Egypt under Moses is recorded that only a couple of them are recorded, Joshua and Caleb, as reaching Canaan. This demonstrates something of how displeasing presumption actually is to God. This is a warning to the Corinthian believers. It was a warning to them, and it's a warning to us. Verse 6 makes that clear. What happened to the people of God was terrible, and terrible things like that happened to them due to their disobedience. The people of God about which Paul is writing were at times idolatrous. They feasted and engaged in play, which is a euphemism here for gross sexual relations after excessive feasting. And that was nothing new. Sexual immorality was a major part of idol worship. Corinth had achieved notoriety in that regard. And by the way, in case you need the reminder, they weren't the last culture to make a god of sexuality. Back to the children of Israel. Apparently, 3,000 of them were killed by the Levites, Exodus 32:28. 20,000 died in the plague, Exodus 32:35. And just so you know, in case you have some atheist friends or others that try to say the Bible's not true and they try to trip you up, Numbers 25 speaks of 24,000 dying. And Paul here mentions 23,000. Both of these are obviously rounded numbers, and Paul may also be making some allowance for those slain by the judges, Numbers 25, verse 5. At any rate, the people complained against Moses, and they complained against God. Paul is pointing out that idolatry puts people in a perilous position. Even after their deliverance, even after God comes through, they were impatient. And Numbers 21:6 records, "Then the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many people of Israel died." They complained against their leaders, they complained against their God, and God said, "Enough." As David Pryor notes, their punishment can be summarized in three dramatic and tragic phases. Number one, they were overthrown. Number two, they fell. Number three, they were destroyed. So God's people are provided for by God in His time. God's people respond with presumption at times. Thirdly, this morning, I want you to recognize God's people should heed God's warnings all the time. God's people should heed God's warnings all the time. Look with me, please, beginning with verse 11. "Now, these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall." All of this, these experiences that Paul has been rehearsing with the people, they were all written down for the instruction of God's people, and we read them for our instruction to this very day. Tragically, among some, not much has changed. As one theologian by the name of Bruce notes, the pattern of divine revelation, human disobedience, and divine judgment manifested in the Israelites' experience from Egypt to Canaan is reproduced in the New Testament era. Like the old country song says, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Or as the writer of Ecclesiastes notes, there is nothing new under the sun. God's people should heed God's warnings all of the time. As people of God, we should heed God's warnings all of the time. There's never a time that we should let down our guard. There's never a time to forego being cautious. We ought to always live with what I call a sense of sanctified paranoia, recognizing that sin really is crouching at the door, and the devil really is moving around like a lion seeking whom he may devour. It's too easy to mess up otherwise. I hate to say this, but I want to remind us all, we can stumble. You can stumble, I can stumble. It's easy to mess up. Just know you can fall. Just know sin is, in fact, lurking around the corner for us. I say it all the time, and people usually kind of grimace when I say it, but I think it's true. In the wrong situation, with the wrong people, at the wrong time, there's not a single sin I'm incapable of committing. And I have a hunch that's true of most of you as well. So God's people are provided for by God in His time. God's people respond with presumption at times. God's people should heed God's warnings all of the time. Fourthly and finally, God's people should take God's way of escape every time. God's people should take God's way of escape every time, verse 13 in our text. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation, He will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. Now, let me remind you what this is not saying. A lot of times people will say something like this, and they think that it's coming from this text, and it's really not. I've heard countless people say that. If you're one of the people that has said that, please don't be offended that I bring it up. But it's not true when people say all the time, God will never give you more than you can handle. He gives us more than we can handle all the time. And He does that so we'll turn to Him in faith and let Him handle it. Can I get a witness? As God's people should take God's way of escape every time. Let me say this as clearly as I can. Ready? You can sin, but you don't have to. You can sin, but you don't have to. You don't have to because God provides a way of escape. You can read about this verse and the nuances related to tempting and testing, but listen, you don't have to sin. God always provides a way out. Now, here's what I find fascinating about this text for today. We've been talking about what Paul has been talking about, and Paul was talking at some point about the Exodus. He's been talking about Israel, and he's been talking about the Exodus, capital E. Now watch this. Paul says in verse 13 that God provides a way of escape. The word there is almost exactly the same word as Exodus. God provided the people of God with Exodus, capital E. God still provides His people with an Exodus. We have a way out. Well, let me wrap this up. It's easy to get on a high horse about sins of others, isn't it? Come on, don't lie in church. I mean, it is. It's easy to get on a high horse about other people's sins and look at them and say, well, I could never, I've said for years, by the way, I would never is oftentimes followed by I can't believe I say all the time that it's easy for me to be judgmental about sins I'm not tempted to commit. But that's not really the way of Jesus, is it? I love what my pastor hero, Steve Brown, reminded me of in an article years ago. He's reminded me of it in other writings too, and it puts it all into perspective for me. Dr. Brown said it this way. He said, it was F.B. Meyer, I believe, who once said that when we see a brother or sister in sin, there are two things we do not know. First, we do not know how hard he or she tried not to sin. And secondly, we do not know the power of the forces that assailed him or her. And then he concluded by saying, we also do not know what we would have done in the same circumstances.